I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Joel Schlosser, Associate Professor of Political Science at Bryn Mawr College. We're discussing his 2020 book, Herodotus in the Anthropocene, from University of Chicago Press. Schlosser's research is on ancient political thought and ancient Athenian democracy, as well as contemporary democracies, in particular our ongoing struggles with inclusion, diversity, and equality. He is the author of many articles, as well as the book, What Would Socrates Do? So first of all, Joel Schlosser, let me welcome you to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you, Jeff. It's an honor to be invited and join this archive of terrific interviews that you've been assembling the last few years.
How kind of you. Joel, I love the book. It was a really, really nice combination of interpretation, close reading of Herodotus with a really thought-provoking application of insights from the ancient world to really pressing contemporary issues. So congrats on the book.
Thank you.
Let me first ask you, as I do, what the motivation was for writing the book.
Well, there are lots of different ways to answer that question. I think one thing you and I share, I believe, is a deep love and appreciation for the tradition of political thought, the history of political thought. And so because of that, for my whole life, I've been trying to spend time with those texts in different ways. And when I was learning Greek, I think it was actually 15 years ago, this last summer, I started reading Herodotus and was just sort of taken by his world. And I mean, I remember just reading book one of the histories is so full of these enthralling, amusing stories, but also stories that sort of hold a pith of wisdom and seem to be adding up to something, even if it's never explicit or obvious. So that seed was planted, and then reading him in Greek and just realizing what a delight that was, and that it wasn't quite as onerous as reading Thucydides, for instance. And when I had a chance to teach Herodotus a few years later, when I was teaching at Carleton College, I leapt at it and had this amazing experience of just seeing, to your sort of observation about both the richness of reading him closely and the abundance of insight that he offers for thinking about the contemporary world, because I was teaching a course on international relations, and I had students who really wanted to think about the war in Afghanistan, and then students who are political philosophy or classics students who just wanted to think about Herodotus and what was contained there. And we had pitched battles that garnered enormous insight. So it was really from that course and seeing everything that could be there that made me think, I really want to spend some time to kind of figure out what thinking politics via Herodotus would garner. And in particular, because Herodotus is not somebody that is in the first row of thinkers that we think about when we're doing ancient political thought. I've long loved ancient political thought and was drawn to the ancients and ancient Greece because of the sort of interest in the origins of democracy and the meaning of rule of the self, ruling, governing the self and others. And Herodotus, as you see in the book, treats that in all sorts of different ways. Yet he's not really brought into the conversation. The conversation is pretty much focused on Athens and Athenian-centric thinkers like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, Thucydides, and some of the tragedians. So there was this sense of like, oh, he's got to add something different. He's such a distinctive voice. And then simultaneously becoming, as I think all of us are, of this growing climate catastrophe and the political challenge of thinking about non-humans and the human relationship to what you might call nature or the environment or things outside the merely human as something that we have to deal with and grapple with politically, which of course, not of course, but fortunately for me, is something that the ancient thinkers were thinking about a lot, and Herodotus in particular. So that was kind of the confluence of circumstances that led to writing the book. And then you know, since this is a, I talk about luck and fate in the book, it's worth noting there was some luck in it, as these things often go. Like, there are multiple directions that I could take in a project, or in my own sort of career of inquiry. My first book was on Socrates and Athenian democracy, and so I was still thinking about tragedy and comedy and things within that those circumstances. But I wrote a fellowship proposal to Harvard Center for Hellenic Studies on Herodotus, and they loved it and funded me. And I found myself in this idyllic environment in DC at their campus working on this book. And it just felt like it was the thing that I had to do. But if not for them, I think nudging me, it may have taken me years more to get back to putting this book together. And I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, the reading about Herodotus, this certainly brings me back, because I think in graduate school, when I was learning Greek, and had to pass my exams, I think my exam was a passage from Herodotus, if I remember correctly. It was like, when Cyrus has the river whipped, is that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I had to translate that. I don't know. Scholars of Greek, ancient Greek political theory, my hats are off to you, because I just, you know, ancient Greek was so difficult, and at least it wasn't Thucydides, though. it could have been much worse, but thankfully I passed my exam, but I haven't really returned to Herodotus much, so I was happy to have this chance to read about him. Let me ask you then about the other part of the title next to the Herodotus. I mean, so we know who Herodotus is, but maybe not all might know what the Anthropocene is. Can you say a little bit about what is the Anthropocene and what is its significance in the book?
Yeah, so the Anthropocene is a term recently invented to describe a new geologic era where human beings have become a force that is transforming the geologic record. So that if in 1,000 years or many more years, people look back, they'll be able to identify, oh, this is when fossil fuels began to be burned at an enormous level, and the sort of sedimentary fossil record is shifted so we can see it. That's the technical definition, but it's become a more general term to think about climate change and climate catastrophe. In fact, I don't think a lot of people who disbelieve in climate change use the term Anthropocene. It's mostly for folks who are centering the human being and human beings in the plural as problems. We're causing new sets of problems with potentially catastrophic effects of rising sea levels or acidifying oceans or wildfires in California or what have you. That, I think, as I was saying earlier, raises a set of political theory questions that I think are really interesting about non-humans, about how human beings can create sustainable forms of life, about what I call in the book earthly flourishing, that is getting beyond the horizon of merely political freedom, but actually a sort of broader flourishing that is including or that involves relationships between humans and non-humans, or among humans and non-humans. That is the sort of theoretical sort of challenge that is laid down by the Anthropocene. The other thing is that I think as I've been doing work in the history of political thought, one of the things that's always important to me, and this goes back to Gadamer and this idea of the fusion of horizons, is being clear about where I'm reading from and not pretending as if I am in a nowhere place that I can just interpret the text on its own terms. I'm reading from the Anthropocene. So these are clearly questions that are coming from this moment in a way that I think if I were reading Herodotus and interpreting him in the 19th century, I would have a different set of concerns. Not that there would be two entirely different Herodotuses, but that perspective for me is important to foreground as one that that I'm bringing to the text. So I'm both reading Herodotus and the Anthropocene. I'm also thinking about the Anthropocene with Herodotus.
Yeah, good. One more question about the Anthropocene, because this is a concept that I have heard, but I haven't really sort of looked into all that much. I mean, one question I guess I have about it is, like, is it a notion that primarily refers to, Well, what you said, this sort of environmental and economic and technological aspects of how human beings relate to the world, or is it, I could imagine sort of a different way of thinking about it, kind of a more broader understanding of a sort of, you know, a modern disposition towards the world that going back to Bacon and Descartes in the early modern era, the sort of revolution in how we think about humanity's place in the world is no longer sort of being part of a cycle of nature, but in developing some kind of mastery over it. And that is sort of what characterizes the Anthropocene and a new way of, characterizing humanity's relationship to the world as assuming a kind of mastery over it. So is it both?
Yeah, I would say that it's both. I mean, there are certainly people who are thinking about the Anthropocene who are really modernists unrepentantly, you know, who still are centering the human being in the ways you're attributing to Bacon. And then there are other people thinking about the Anthropocene who are anti-modern. So I'm thinking about somebody like Murray Bookchin or somebody like William Ophuls, who are both kind of eccentric scholars in their respective ways, but are sort of using the Anthropocene or the sort of set of problems to say we need to go a totally different direction. I'm, you know, as coming from where I'm coming, I like both of them, you know, and I think there's a tension between drawing out conclusions that fit into the kind of modernist Anthropocene conversation. So that's somebody, you know, like Bruno Latour is somebody who I would put strongly in that camp. And my attraction to the anti-modern sentiment of the rescaling of man's hubris, which I think is very strongly in Herodotus, you know, saying human beings aren't the only ones on stage. Whereas this sort of modernist approach that I think you're naming, which is part of the Anthropocene too, is like the very fact that it's called the Anthropocene, that the human being, the Anthropos, is put at the center of this epoch, even though the problems or like the ramifications are precisely because the Anthropos is at the center. You know, like, this is one of the kind of suggestions in the work of Donna Haraway, who's wanting to rename it the Kuluocene, because that's a way of mystifying the kinds of relations and bringing to the foreground non-humans and not just committing the same error of centering the human being.
Okay, yeah, that's good. I mean, I want to ask a little bit later, close to your conclusion about the sort of modernist, whether there's room for a kind of modern orientation here, because it makes sense in it to me to return to a kind of ancient thinker to respond to what seems to be a really deeply rooted problem in modernity, which is this kind of, you know, Promethean impulse to transform the world, right? And so it requires some kind of response from antiquity where we didn't have that kind of disposition. I'd be interested to hear if you can like Bruno Latour, you can sort of maintain a modernist credentials there, because it seems to me to be a difficult gulf to bridge. So before we get there, though, let's talk more about Herodotus. So maybe you could just talk about your thesis a little bit, to say a little bit about what overall Herodotus can offer to us, how he can guide us in the Anthropocene. He wrote obviously long before the Anthropocene started. So what's the overall picture here how he can help us?
Well, the single phrase, this sort of culminating idea, is this idea of earthly flourishing. And with that phrase, I think Herodotus is describing a condition of health and abundance that's shared by humans and non-humans. But there are two ways, sort of main tracks that I'm drawing, elucidating in the book to try to get to that idea. The first is like substantially what Herodotus is giving us in terms of concepts and how those concepts are guiding political analysis. And the concepts that I'm working out are this concept of the nature of things being all political political things being unboundable and not restricted to the things that we typically think of as politics, and certainly not only those things pertaining to the polis. So we need to think about terrains and animals and the gods, or at least things that aren't fully nameable or comprehensible. And there's, of course, this tendency, even among political theorists, who I think are the great complicators of political science, to draw stark lines around a domain and say, this is politics and this isn't. And Herodotus is confronting that. And one of the political concepts that he's putting in there that I'm sure you're going to have lots to talk about, because it sounds, is very Hegelian in the way that I'm describing it, is the concept of nomos, or plural is nomoi. And these are, rather than thinking about institutions exclusively as the site where politics happens, they are, it's a much more fluid concept to describe what is often translated as customs or culture, but also includes laws. And so Herodotus is interested in how different people have different nomoi. And these nomoi are dynamic. They depend upon ongoing practice of collective groups of people, but they also sort of sediment and become increasingly solid, so that you can speak of the particular nomoi of a people across time, or having developed in a particular way. I mean, they have a sort of traditional aspect. Different nomoi for Herodotus can be organized in different ways that are more or less beneficial for achieving or pursuing earthly flourishing. And over the course of the histories, he's showing through contrast and sort of suggestive comment that ones, that nomoi that are built around equality, and equality in particular of participation in a kind of public space, are those nomoi that are best equipped to contribute to earthly flourishing. So he has a sort of this sort of theoretical structure that I'm drawing out of the histories, which, for those who haven't read it, the histories are not a theoretical text. Like, they're stories, and they're an account of a war that goes back for hundreds of years before the actual war that was the war that Herodotus lived in the shadow of. So these are sort of beneath the surface in a way that's different from, say, a Platonic dialogue or Aristotle, or let alone Hobbes or Hegel or something, where they're actually, you know, developing theoretical arguments on the face of what their texts are saying. That's the theoretical structure. But I think at the same time, there's like what I describe as the how, that is the form of his making this argument. And this is actually related to his being a storyteller. That form is a form that places inquiry in a particular perspective and experience that's dependent upon relationships with others, and that privileges, or at least brings up from subordinate place, knowledge that is held in stories and myths and other forms of narrative, as opposed to knowledge that is, can be put into a series of logical claims or a syllogism or something. So he is the how of relating these concepts is embedded within a, what I call an itinerant inquiry, like a traveling questioning account that's always reflexive about the conditions of its knowledge. And so in that sense, it's a sort of provisional, limited account, one that is anti-modern in the sense of being opposed to this, the idea that we could have a sort of holistic, totalizing science of these things. He's sort of constantly making us aware, he, the narrator of the histories, of what he knows firsthand through his own investigation and what it depends upon the stories of others. And that's important to me because I think one of the challenges of the Anthropocene is that this climate crisis goes along with certain ways of knowing and sort of sets of assumptions about how we can develop knowledge and operationalize it in the world that exclude the kinds of, you might say, softer or squishy stories and inquiries that Herodotus exemplifies. Herodotus, of course, like, has his descendants in ethnographies and anthropologists and certain kinds of historians today, but he's not, his forum is not really taken up in political analysis or political inquiry in ways that I think are potentially contributing to the very same crisis that he's, that I'm calling the Anthropocene.
Right. Yeah. I took your book to be, and, you know, tell me if this is wrong, but
you know, Herodotus to be a figure who is anti-hubris and in a sort of comprehensive way, that our hubris can be expressed in any number of ways, especially through the attempt to master the political world in the form of being a tyrant, or even more comprehensively, an attempt to sort of give a comprehensive account of history or of philosophy, being a sort of tyrant in, of history or philosophy, and rather to be sort of open to the revision and dynamism and complexity of the world and to wonder at it, right? And that, you know, and so that's what unites. I mean, I found the structure of your book very good because you sort of alternate between Herodotus's take on the dynamic complexity of the world with a self-reflexive approach to the dynamic complexity of the activity of doing political theory itself. And so, you know, those two projects go hand in hand, which I appreciate it. I mean, is that, I hope that was accurate.
Yeah, that's accurate. And that, I mean, I think it's something that I haven't found a lot of other political theory arguments putting in the foreground, which is what sort of forms, how is form inhibiting the kinds of knowledge or the kinds of arguments that we're making? Because there is, you and I are experienced enough in this field, like we've published enough articles, you know what the form of a political theory article looks like. And it's something that actually is kind of foreign to people outside of the conversation. But Herodotus is challenging, I mean, he's inventing this amazing polyglottal form, like this form that holds all sorts of different kinds of things, speeches and debates and stories and his observations and the things that the Egyptian priests told him and, you know, hearsay about what oracles said. And it somehow all holds together. And that, I think, allows for a different kind of political knowledge from what you would have if you are making a straightforward argument.
Yeah, so I wanted to, speaking of the scholarship, I wanted to, before diving into the chapters, you engage with the scholarship, I think, throughout the book, but I wanted to see if you could just say something briefly up front about how your Herodotus compares with some of the other Herodotuses that are out there. This is, you know, what you're taking here, the sort of view of him as, I don't know, most a proto postmodern figure in a way. I mean, is this something that others have been attuned to, or, you know, you're making a radical break with other scholars on their takes of Herodotus?
Not making a radical break. I think, you know, Herodotus is, although not talked about much in political theory and certainly not in political science, has long been beloved in classics and classical studies. And one of the great pleasures of writing this book was actually encountering just amazing, terrific work in classics by people like Leslie Kirk and Carolyn DeWald and Nero Lawagi and John Marancola, and the list could go on. Rosaria Munson, my colleague at Swarthmore. So that's there is a real sense among some of those people and others that Herodotus has a kind of postmodern edge, that he's, you know, quasi-relativistic, that his sort of level of reflexivity is profound among his contemporaries and today. So there, I think a lot of my work was synthetic of all this scholarship that nobody in political science really, aside from a few people, reads. And that was a great pleasure of being at the Center for Hellenic Studies, so I could get to know those folks and others who had that kind of approach. But in political theory, political philosophy, I think the big thing is nobody really has written, has taken an account of the histories as a whole, sort of on their own terms. And one of my models here, just as a book, was Jill Frank's book on Aristotle, Democracy of Distinction, where I think she really is organizing her chapters around concepts that are, and developing a distinctive Aristotelian account of those concepts. So my hope is that people in political theory generally, not just people in ancients, could say, oh, like, here's actually a really useful account of nomoi or of eleutheria, freedom, and it's a distinctively Herodotian account of those particular concepts. That's, we don't have to go to Aristotle's definition of them, or this is a contrast to Aristotle's definition of them. Although I intentionally kept out those you know, working out those particular distinctions, thinking that's something I'd rather do in an article than in the book, just to keep the book's flow going and not to get too bogged down. I would say, so vis-a-vis political theory, the main thing is doing something that's never been done before. But at the level of the sort of substance of the argument, I think, and this comes out maybe the most in the last chapter, the fifth chapter, because it's the most sort of obviously political theory chapter, that there is a divide among people doing ancient political thought, a focus on virtue, arete, as a sort of central political concept. And that sort of, I think, comes out primarily from folks working on Plato and Aristotle, to from them to focusing on Eleutheria and demokratia, democracy, to some extent. And on that, I think I'm taking a pretty strong position that Herodotus is the thinker for reckoning with how freedom is a central concept in ancient political thought, and maybe the central organizing concept prior to virtue and arete, or maybe not prior to, because of course virtue and arete was part of the sort of epic narrative prior to him, but equal weight, logically, not posterior to virtue.
Okay, so I have questions about all five of your chapters, so we'll see how much we can get through here.
Yeah, shoot, we'll do a lightning round.
Right. Chapter one. Okay, so as I mentioned, your chapters alternate. The odd chapters talk about the substance of politics, and the even number chapters talk about the sort of methods reflecting on the activity of theorizing about politics. And so, to start with, the first chapter about which, you know, takes up Herodotus's view of you talk about the complexity of politics. Mm-hmm. In the diversity of things, human and non-human, that interact and have to be taken account of. I was wondering. I mean, you could sort of lay that out, expand on that a little bit, and maybe with some examples that you use from the text. But you know, one of the questions that I had here was about. I think you used the term both complexity and diversity. Mm-hmm. And those are, of course, different. I don't know if there was, you know, sort of, because you can have something complex that's not very diverse, or something diverse that's not very complex. So, is it both, or is it primarily one or the other for him?
Yeah, that's a great question. I hadn't really thought about how those don't go together, because I think without looking at the word by word how I use those terms, I think that I do use them. Not interchangeable, but almost synonymously. So I think the essence of that, the argument in that chapter, is that there are like this language. I find the language of domain useful. So that most of the time when we think about politics, we think here's the domain of things that are politically salient, and I. Invoke Sheldon Wolin as one of my epigraphs to the book, and I really take his vision of what political theory does seriously, which he says one of the things political theory does, and this is in the introduction to Politics and Vision, is it makes political things salient, and that one of the that Herodotus's attention to, I'll use the word complexity, of all living things. Is to call attention to make more things politically salient than one would have thought were politically salient. And sort of the one particular way that he does this that I focused on in chapter one is showing how the search for causes, and in particular the causes of the war between the Persians and the Greeks, which was like the definitive war of his generation, and in many ways the definitive war of ancient Greek world, because it's what led Athens to its position of primacy. And we would not have, I don't think it's too much of an exaggeration, we wouldn't have the Parthenon and many of the accomplishments of Athens without the victory over the Persians, which enabled them to secure hegemony and tribute paying allies in the ancient world. So imagine the Acropolis and look at it and think about how did that come to be? And that's sort of the question that Herodotus is asking. And he's saying, you scratch the surface and then you see that you can't just start at the most obvious cause, that the causes are manifold. They're both psychological, they're contingencies, they're accidents, they're figures that you didn't think were part of this conversation or part of really relevant turn out to be relevant. So I love the fact that he says at the beginning of the history, he's like, I'm going to explain the war between the Persians and the Greeks. And then says, but you know, we have to like look at Croesus and the Lydians, who isn't even part of this war in any sort of way, to see where the starting figure is. This is the one that he knows had a hand because he was the first to commit an injustice against the Greeks. So this, from the very beginning, he's pointing out that the figures that are in the event that you want to describe aren't sufficient for explaining the event itself. And again, complicating that tendency that we have to draw a circle around the actors or the political things that we think are salient, and saying that we need to revise that view.
So, yeah, one of the questions I had was about the very, very beginning. So that, I mean, it's good you talk about the beginning of things. From the proem, at the very beginning, the opening part of the histories, and this is just quoting from where, I didn't go back to the text myself, but you quote Herodotus as saying, the purpose is to prevent, this is the purpose of the histories as a whole, so I took this to be really important, to prevent the traces of human events from being erased by time and to preserve the fame of the most important and remarkable achievements produced by both Greeks and non-Greeks. I wanted to get you sort of your take on that sweeping statement of the purpose of the book, because one of the reasons I highlight that is there's a way in which Herodotus here seems to be doing something maybe different than what you're emphasizing, which is that he's pointing out what his effort is to kind of fight back against the tendencies of nature, which is to sort of dissolve all things into oblivion, and indeed fight against the tendency of nature towards mediocrity by holding up forms of excellence, right? So there's a way in which, you know, the histories itself, even from the beginning, is like, it maybe can be conceived as a kind of hubris, because it's trying to master time itself and be immortal and hold up forms of excellence, right? And in that way, it's kind of Homeric. That's my next question of its connection to Homer. But what do you think about the proem line?
Yeah, I mean, I love the proem, and I think, I mean, there's so many things to say about it. One is, it is, as I say this in the text, it's very explicitly Homeric, because he's describing how he doesn't want these events to lose their kleos, their fame, which is the sort of key word of what heroes strive for in the Homeric epic. So he is concerned about exactly that, the sort of that these stories will no longer be told about the great deeds that happened in the past. I do think, like, in this sense, Herodotus's world is very different from our world. There is this fear of effacement, you know, like you can imagine the dust blowing so long that the stone tablets lose all sense of what was written there. That is as real in a way that in our age of what Timothy Morton calls hyperobjects, things that last beyond beyond our comprehension. Like, look around this room that you're sitting in, and these plastic things that are going to live so far into the future that nobody will remember who you are, and that thing will still be sitting there, right? That was not imaginable in Herodotus's world. And so, like, I think he is, I'm not sure I would say hubristic, because I think the sense of the world is like totally inverted. There's this ephemerality of human life that is Herodotus's starting point, and to try to build something, like to go back to the Parthenon, that lasts is, there's no way that it can be thought of as eternal. It's always going to fall. Everything is going to fall apart. The great things rise and the great things fall and the small things rise again. That's in the proem also, this sense of needing to cover things that people have forgotten. He's bringing things out of the shadows of history because they've already been forgotten, even though they're there for him to apprehend and see and detect. But it is it's a project of remembrance of greatness. And this is something I return to across the book, and especially towards the end, this sort of sense of the miraculousness of human action that Herodotus, I think, celebrates, and that the histories are a record of miraculous action, both by the memorable, the people we don't forget, like Xerxes or Themistocles or other, you know, great heroes, but also people whose names are forgotten. I mean, I love to retell the story of the thief and Rhampsinitus, and we don't ever actually have the names of the thieves. It's just a remarkable story that Herodotus loves because it's sort of an ordinary person or people whose ingenuity outsmarts the king, which is a classic kind of tale that Herodotus would be attracted to. Other ordinary figures who do somewhat extraordinary things, whose stories he wants to record for posterity. But just one other thing about the Homeric thing that you can, and you can push this farther, I think it is, and I talk about this in the book, it's not Homeric for him to say, I'm going to give you an apodeixis of my historia. I'm going to give you a display of my inquiry. There's no invocation of the muses here. This isn't like a poetic inspiration. He's instead saying, I'm going to show you the results of all of this work that I've done. Like, I've spent a lifetime going to these places, talking to people, climbing up the hill to like see, could they have spotted the ships from this spot, or did they need to be in another spot? That this is all a display, a putting on exhibition, all this work that I've done. And in that sense, it's not Homeric, it's not poetic, at least explicitly. And yet he's also invoking these sort of poetic tropes. So it's marrying what I refer to as his Hippocratic influence, this sort of idea that is coming out of Ionian region where Herodotus lived, that you could look at symptoms and study the body and understand things through observation and inquiry. You know, the word autopsy is in Greek looking for yourself, and Herodotus uses that word to describe how he's confirming stories that have been told. That isn't Homeric, right? The poet just knows because the inspiration is coming to him and hides himself behind his beautiful rhetoric and lyric. So Herodotus is not doing that, but he also then is saying, I want to tell these stories so that they don't lose their kleos. And he does tell memorable stories such that, you know, you remember the story that you had to translate, and I can be at a wedding and tell somebody I'm writing on Herodotus, and this guy who's an architect has nothing to do with classics or the academy or anything will say, oh yeah, like that's this story I remember from reading Herodotus, because he tells great stories, you know, as good as any Homer tells.
Yeah, good. So is the, let me take a shot at it. I mean, is the difference between Homer and Herodotus here on this maybe a different, you know, Herodotus is more democratic in this sense that, you know, they're both concerned about preserving fame, great deeds, and so forth. But Herodotus is also interested in explaining the mundane, and the disposition that he wants the reader to take is not one of kind of like awe and reverence or arousing our ambition for the few to match the few, but it's as you say in the book, you know, throughout, a kind of wonder at the greatness of lots of different things, including average or everyday things, right? Mm-hmm. Even thieves who are kind of interesting, thieves who are interesting. So, yeah, do you think that you know, he sort of democratizes? I mean, that's like, I guess the short way of what I'm suggesting here. He sort of democratizes the Homeric tradition.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. And I would also add that while he's doing that, I mean, think about Plato, the critiques of Homer and of poetry in general in Plato's Republic. Herodotus escapes those because even though he's in using stories and mesmerizing his readers, he's also pulling back the curtain and showing how he came to the ideas that he did. And so there's no danger of him, you know, leading somebody to believe that he knows more than he knows. Whereas that's the criticism that is leveled at the poets, is that they only have imitations of knowledge, right? They haven't actually looked for themselves. They're simulating it so that you can believe that this is the case. And that's not something Herodotus can be charged with.
Right. Yeah. I do have a question too about eventually if we get the difference between Plato, because, you know, I mean, Plato, at least I take it to be one of the deep worries from Socrates or Plato's point of view about the poets is, the way in which they conceive of an irrational world, or at least an incompletely rational world, and which is sort of covered over in certain ways by these beautiful speeches and beautiful deeds. Whereas Herodotus puts the irrational fully on display. Well, maybe this is the time to talk about it, because this chapter, at least, I mean, another way to put what you're saying about complexity and diversity of the world, the on the inability of us to fully sort of offer a complete analysis, is just to say that the world itself is not fully rational, right? And that this is, I mean, is that the right way to put it? Because that's, you know, this is a deep concern on from Plato's point of view. I mean, it's difficult to know how to be action guiding, to conceive of what the best sort of life is, if, you know, if we can't take our cues from the rationality of the world.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that writing this book led me to appreciate more is Aristotle, and just the sense of that maybe the best we have is a kind of practical wisdom about living in the world, in part because I think Aristotle had a sense of contingency that isn't evident, at least on certain readings of Plato's dialogues. And I don't want to totally agree to the way you're characterizing the sort of Platonic worldview, but I think I can see where that's coming from. But also this sense that there's only a certain kind of knowledge we can have about political matters and ethical matters for that way matter. And I think Herodotus, again, because he has this sort of ethnographic, this attention to just writing the stories that he's encountering through people's approach and imagination, he doesn't truck with a lot of universal claims. And often those that are often quoted as from his work to say, this is what Herodotus is saying, in the broader context, he's reporting what somebody else said, or he then undercuts it subsequently in the action of the narrative. Christopher Pelling has this new book on Herodotus, which is, I think, really rich. And I have a review of it coming out in Polis, where he calls this sort of provisional revision, that Herodotus will make claims, and then subsequently he will put them in tension with other things, and never calling attention to the way in which that's not entirely clear, but kind of complicating as he goes along, adding more folds. But it does leave, I mean, this was one of the big things that came out of when I taught this course on international relations with Herodotus, is, you know, people like Thucydides because he seems to give such clear conclusions about, here's what we need to do. Herodotus doesn't, you know, he leaves us frustrated about what the right strategy would be, other than a kind of chastened or humbled one. One that is ready to revise, ready to, you know, respond dynamically.
Yeah, and so is that? I mean, if this is the answer to the question, it's fine. But is that the essence of the difference between Thucydides and Herodotus? I mean, I'm just sort of locating Herodotus, in the interest of locating Herodotus in ancient political thought. I had these questions to how he relates to Homer and Plato and Thucydides. So you mentioned Thucydides. So is that? They're both historians. Mm-hmm. Is that the essence of the difference in the worldview there between the two of them?
Yeah, I think it is. I have an article called Herodotean Realism where I do work this out a little more detailed, sort of saying how his approach to reality, I think, is better suited what I think reality actually is than Thucydides. I mean, one thing about Thucydides is like I said, he gives the impression of leading to, you know, clear actionable items, but I think there are subtle ways in which he calls those into questions too. But he sets up the work as a guide, or a much more of a strategic sort of document than Herodotus does. And in that sense, I think Herodotus, like I think of Herodotus as really opening us up to a host of phenomena that we need to now consider as politically interesting. And Thucydides, and he's thus a complicator. Thucydides prefers parsimony. He likes to bring us to the what he thinks to be the essential thing. Like, think about when Thucydides describes the plague in Athens, and he says, I don't know the causes of this plague, but let me give you this amazing description of all the symptoms and what might have caused it. The way that Herodotus would approach that particular incident, I think would be much more colorful than scientific. You know, there's a sense in which Thucydides really wants to, he wants to prevent this from happening again, or for people to know that it was starting, and thus respond appropriately in the future. Whereas Herodotus is just sort of fascinated by things, I think, in a more poetic kind of imaginative way, which may be politically less responsible or useful.
Okay, good. Yeah, that was my question about one of my questions about the next chapter. So I'm going to move to that in chapter two, where you sort of pivot from, you know, Herodotus's critique of tyrants in the first chapter to the critique of a tyrannical way of doing history. At least that's how I read it. And that you know, Herodotus is reflecting on how to do history through his history, in part by the kind of open-ended and revisionary way in which he's engaged in it. So, he doesn't, for example, or he unsettles, uses and then unsettles kind of categories and structures, and leaves open how to think about these things. I thought maybe you could say a little bit about that effort on Herodotus' part, maybe, you know, use a few examples to make it concrete.
Yeah, so one of the concept that was sort of guiding me in the second chapter, which is a little bit of a mouthful, but in Greek it's oikoumene, and you can translate it the known or the inhabited world. And this is kind of a cool concept because it's one of Herodotus's lasting imprints on ancient knowledge. Like it got taken up by geographers and his subsequent historians, not people that political theorists really read, but became a really important concept. And basically the idea is that the things that we can map and that fit into our sort of grids of understanding are knowable, but then there are outsides to that knowable world. So rather than think that it's a sort of reflexive move about saying what we know we've been able to apprehend or we have accounts of, but what we don't know, we can't even say what we don't know, right? Like, what is it, Rumsfeld? Like the known unknowns. Like the knowable world is all the things that are known and known unknowns, but then there are unknown unknowns. And that's what's outside of the knowable world. So the way that Herodotus uses that term and calls attention to it is by describing, in particular, in that chapter, I'm looking at his Egypt narrative, which the first time I read Herodotus, I got pretty bogged down in chapter two, in book two, which is the Egypt narrative, because he goes off course in some sense from this march towards the confrontation between the Persians and the Greeks, and digresses into Egypt for the longest book of the entire histories. But I think that it's actually a really crucial chapter for Herodotus to show what he is doing. And Seth Benedetti, who has one of the other few political philosophers who has written a whole book on Herodotus, he kind of makes that case in his particular way, which is hard for me to fully claim I understand. But I think that he puts Egypt centrally too. So basically, the idea is that Egypt was considered conventionally when Herodotus is writing to be a kind of inversion of the Greek world, you know, that everything that they did there was different. So the men sat down to go to the bathroom and the women stood up, that sort of thing. But what Herodotus states that early in the narrative, but then he subsequently shows how these two cultures, Greek and Egyptian, are much more interrelated with one another. And rather than being inverted, there's a kind of historical relationship that, such that certain Greek gods descend from Egyptian gods, not in the sense of like father, son, but they have their original manifestations are in Greece or in Egypt. And that the Greeks have long had trading relationships with the Egyptians that have been reciprocal based upon a ship being blown off course and settlers colonizing the edge of Egypt. And so again, they're not inverted so much as interrelated and in this historical relationship. So the known world, whereas it previously fit into this what Francois Ortaud calls the sort of grids and polarities of the Greeks being above, the Egyptians below, the Greeks being upright, the Egyptians being bent over, that actually that subsequently doesn't work. And so this inquiry is a way of showing how the kind of the ways in which we fit knowledge together have to be undone. And then we have to begin with knowing from encounter and story and relationship.
Good. Yeah. I mean, so to, I guess, follow up on your aside there, when you were talking a few minutes ago about possibly the politically irresponsible character of Herodotus's view. I mean, I guess one of the things that occurred to me in reading this chapter and the first chapter was, you know, what Herodotus is asking us to do, kind of disposition that we take towards the world, is one of wonder at its sort of irreducible mm-hmm. complexity. You know, I mean, it might be all well and good if the world is kind of benign, but the world is pretty harsh at the same time, yeah. too, right? So, you know, it might be difficult, or at least require a lot of, I don't know, one must be privileged to take a sort of wonder-filled view of the world, that, you know, we need to act in the world, which requires us to simplify it and not you know, engage in reflection. So I don't know what you think of that. I mean, is Herodotus asking too much in terms of complexifying things, in terms of reflecting on seeing the interrelationship between things, whereas, you know, he's not giving us enough in terms of action guiding principles?
Yeah, I mean, I had a student who read this, a former student who's now doing great things in the world, and he raised a similar question with respect to the Anthropocene. I mean, do we have time, A, to like develop this very complicated account of how everybody is interrelated and contributing to this when the crisis is pressing, the hurricane is coming? And do we have time, A, and B, do we really need to? Because we know where the like chief problems lie, you know, with respect to climate change. You know, we can identify where the emissions are coming from and where major changes need to be happening, even if there's more complexity than that simplification. But so I think this is another version of your question. And to that, I'd say Herodotus is just simply doing something else. So, I mean, one is I'm not proposing him as a solution to these problems, and another, he is certainly not proposing himself as a solution. I think that he's most immediately, in terms of his audience, he is writing to try to pull the reins back on the Athenian Empire as it is lurching headlong to the same fate as the Persians. And you might say, why isn't he more direct? I think because that's not his only, you know, ambition in doing this work. He's also sort of he's a polymath. You know, he's interested in science and language and religion and all these other things at the same time as he's interested in politics. And we political theorists tend to, you know, focus only on the bona fides and the political, but there's a lot more wisdom about living human life, I think, that Herodotus contains, thanks to the fact that he didn't only focus on warning the Athenians against their political fate. But I think, you know, in our political moment, where we are sort of, especially in the United States, feeling this sense of like heightened contrast and confrontation and antagonism, Herodotus sounds a dissonant note. I mean, to my mind, that sort of wonder you might imagine it romantically of like, turning your back on the news cycle and all these important things that we need to be paying attention to and weighing in on might actually be really beneficial for returning us to what it means to be a human being and the kind of breadth of human life and experience. But it's true that it doesn't articulate a position that we can then, or a policy that we can then implement immediately. And I think I can even be accused of bringing Herodotus too much to a point by the end of the book of like developing a political vision, which I try to avoid by sort of, you know, and why you probably want to get to that in a little bit, but by being clear that it's not Herodotus that I'm speaking for. By the time I'm getting to the end and trying to imagine some other way of being together other than the way that we think of the world now. I mean, last thing on that, when I was teaching at Deep Springs, that's when I wrote my first article on Herodotus in the summer of 2012. And this question of what is a world? I mean, why is it that we take the world to be this particular way and not that way? I mean, you said the world's also a harsh place. That this is a question that has occupied me for a long time and was sort of crystallized when I was there, because living in an isolated, intentional community, one that wasn't the way that we think of it, the world living in urban communities and on, you know, attached to college and university campuses, really makes you realize that there isn't one world. There is not one horizon of what it means to be a world. And I wrote much of this book living in Rwanda. That's a very different world. I mean, you could say it's affected by many of the same things that we are affected by in this world, and that's certainly true. But the sort of assumptions of, well, we live in this unkind world that we have to deal with, I think are provincial. And that's something actually Herodotus helped me to understand.
Yeah, good. So the third chapter is on nomos, nomoi. And I have to talk about it because you opened up the Hegel.
I know. That's why I was looking forward to that part. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I take it what you mean by the Hegelian reference earlier is that for Herodotus, nomos is not primarily or entirely about the laws of the land as they're written down or not written down or embodied in institutions, but rather also those sort of more informal cultural norms or mores that vary from culture to culture and really cut across this nature convention dichotomy that you see in a lot of ancient political thought. So I appreciated this and your discussion. It's for Herodotus, nomoi are not, you know, determined by nature. Particular people is not determined by its geography or climate, but nor is or its law is just purely arbitrary either. It's not purely simply convention. So maybe we could say a little bit about what nomoi means, what nomos means for Herodotus, and what its significance is in terms of his contribution to political theory on this.
Yeah. I mean, I said that it's often translated as culture, custom, or law, and I think it's useful to remember that because it doesn't. Herodotus is not trying to nail down the meaning so much as these are meanings that arise in the course of his using the term in a lot of different ways, and I go through those in the books in some detail with specific examples. But one of the insights about nomos that I think is especially important in Herodotus is that nomos is a practice, that they aren't just things that are out there. They're things that are alive and that exist because people are doing them. And their substance depends upon that reiteration or continuous iteration. So Herodotus is interested in how nomoi change and how nomoi adjust, but that always sort of goes back to the people that are developing them in responsive interaction with non-humans. So they're, you know, terrain, their environment, the ways in which they produce food, their trading relationships, the gods, etc. You know, this is another future project. Plato's Laws is the nomoi, there hasn't been a lot of close attention to how this term shifts. Martin Oswald, who I wish that I could have met, because he was for a long time faculty at Penn and Swarthmore, has this book from Popular Sovereignty to Nomos, where he sort of traces the move from incoherence in law towards greater coherence and sort of legalized formal institutions. I think Herodotus kind of stands at a transformational moment there, where he's both able to reach back towards informal forms of collective organizations and to see the development of formal ones, but not to see that as progress or teleology necessarily, because he has a lot of respect for autochthonous or indigenous ways of organizing collective life. So One of the ways in which, in terms of ancient political thought and just political theory more generally, that I think Nomos is a really interesting contribution is thinking about how law and somebody like Robert Cover, I think, has done really beautiful, brilliant work on this in the American context. Law is more than just what's in the books or what's been upheld by a court decision. That law is a story, and law is something that is that its power and its influence depend upon people believing in it and acting according to it. And that's one of the things that Herodotus, I think, is evoking in his many stories about what nomoi are. And then there's this other important dimension, which is that isonomia, equality of the laws or equality of access, is a term that Herodotus also introduces over the course of his narrative. So he's showing how nomoi can be organized and sort of developed in different ways that are more or less amenable to principles of equality. And I think it's a little buried in this book, and you probably need to write an article to get it out there. There's been a lot of misunderstanding of the difference between isonomia, isokratia, and isogoria, which are these three equality related terms that come up in Herodotus for describing different formations of nomoi. And some scholars, including really distinguished ones, just sort of say they're all basically the same. They're not. And I think that the way in which Herodotus treats them and his sort of skepticism towards isonomia, for instance, which was a buzzword in Athenian democracy and was, I think, like kind of a propaganda tool, the way that land of the free is in the United States, for instance, signifies a sort of skepticism about laws that are only on the books, or in, you know, with the case of isonomia, it was inscribed on the statue of the tyrant slayers who are positioned at the entrance to the agora, the marketplace in Athens, and instead emphasizing how the built world institutions, to some extent, but also just architecture of social arrangements, needed to reflect those. And his preference for isagoria, which is a sort of equal access to the marketplace, to the public space, which you might think of as like a kind of public equality, I think reflects that. So he's, nomoi have these are the substance of political life, political and social life, and they have different ways of being organized. And Herodotus is prioritizing, or at least leading us to think about the potential priority of equality as a way of organizing nomoi.
Huh. Yeah, that's good. I mean, it leads into my next question, which is about the Spartan law. Mm-hmm. Is that involves isn't it the first example of isonomia, or no?
No, isokratia is the Spartans.
Isokratia. Yeah. Okay. Well, so feel free to speak about that. But I get one of the things that I was curious about when thinking about Lycurgus's laws, which would have been one of the most famous mm-hmm. examples of nomoi at the time. I mean, what's striking about them is kind of how unnatural they are in a certain way, right? How mm-hmm. they sort of turn against our natural instincts and they're a pattern for models in Plato's Republic, right? And having women fight alongside the men and having mm-hmm. children in common, et cetera. I just wonder about how that fits with, I guess, the effacement between the nature and convention dichotomy and sort of more organic view of nomos that you're drawing out of Herodotus. Like, so how does Herodotus think about Lycurgus's laws? I mean, you might think that it might be an example of tyranny, right? Because it's mm-hmm. an example of, here's a single ruler who seeks to sort of impress a total way of life on a people. But it's, in fact, that doesn't seem to be that, right? Herodotus is, you know, sort of admirer of Lycurgus. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really interesting, I mean, I think maybe another way of putting it is if Herodotus is sort of trying to break down the relationship between nature and convention, why is he, a way like the emphasis on nomoi is also an emphasis on convention. I think, maybe this is just reflecting the way that you're using nature, Jeff, just makes me think about Hegel again. And I think that it's different from...
I bring that out in people.
Yeah, yeah. It's different from nature, Phusis in Herodotus. So like it isn't, and I don't want to mischaracterize Hegel at all in this, but like this, so... Vlastos, Gregory Vlastos, amazing scholar of ancient philosophy, has this argument that about how isonomia emerged from pre-Socratic reflections on justice and equality in the cosmos. And I think that sort of idea that people who are thinking, like early physicists and medical writers, were thinking about how to balance nature. And so that like this nature, rather than the way in your example, like nature is sort of a source of unbalance, like excessive desire, like sort of Hobbesian nature that needs control, that that was that the there was a sort of natural principle or an order of nature inherent in it, in the sort of Greek imagination. I'm being vague here because it's not, this isn't in Herodotus, but I think it's a sort of background that nomoi could channel in some way or hold. So like I use this metaphor of tempering and something being well tempered at one moment in the book, like trying to get it. So like the tempering something means that you're getting it in its proper tune or order. And that was, I think, the way that he's imagining nomoi. So with respect to the Spartans, and if it had been working, then it showed some evidence that it was not totally contrary to nature. You know, the fact that I think that if Lycurgus had been in his time and had introduced it, he would have been skeptical. But the fact that it had taken root and seemed to be sustaining itself leads Herodotus to admire it to some degree. That said, like he's not very he admires the Spartan, their functional advantages, but he does not associate them with the kind of earthly flourishing or success that I think he does associate Athens, and that he, you know, puts in the name in the mouths of some of other figures across the history, like Otanes, the Persian, or the various potential tyrants in Ionia. So his praise for Lycurgus, I think, has more to do with the fact that the Spartan regime has lasted and seems to be flourishing to some degree than to do with its successful, you know, that it, having it adhere to some better balancing principle than Isagoria, which isn't to say, I mean, I think that I'm sort of accepting the premise of your question, which is that the Spartans are doing something contrary to nature, and in that sense, probably don't, aren't going to give, I mean, that's why Herodotus does not recommend them, even though he's not criticizing them. He doesn't criticize a lot of the peoples and political organizations that he observes. I mean, there are a few moments when he says, I find this kind of thing or this practice disgusting or reprehensible. And he doesn't say that about anything Spartan. But he's generally pretty ecumenical when it comes to political organizations, so long as they're not falling apart. You know, like if they've perdured, they're worthy of some admiration.
Yeah, good. Okay. I mean, this is the deep Burkean elements that I see in Herodotus. So that's good. I mean, this gets us to the last chapter on earthly flourishing, because I wanted you to expand on what actually Herodotus means by that. The first step on the way to that, I take it, is his view of freedom, which, as you say, is not just, it's opposed to slavery, but it's not just at the individual level, but also a freedom and enslavement at the collective level, that people mm-hmm. as a whole can be enslaved to a single ruler, or can be free and self-determining or democratic. So, and Herodotus advocates for freedom at the collective. You know, he's, as you said at the beginning, he's a sort of early Democrat here. So you can say, I mean, feel free to say more about that, about freedom in Herodotus, but also kind of how it's connected to his view of earthly flourishing, or the good life, I guess I would call it, for simplicity's sake.
Yeah, yeah, the good life for all earthlings, not just human beings.
Ah, right. Okay, good. Yeah, because it's connected with the flourishing of the whole, not just the flourishing of our species. That's good.
Yeah, so when like an early version, when I first finished this manuscript, it was called Ecologies of Freedom. And like I have an early article that was on Herodotus called Political Ecologies, Herodotus' Political Ecologies. And that, when I talked about people with that, workshopped it actually at Bryn Mawr, it was brought up again and again in different ways how freedom has a kind of anthropocentric resonance to it. It doesn't capture these broad, like how nomoi themselves are involved in dynamic relationship with non-humans. Like Herodotus is not, he's not leading us to believe that we can kind of construct a human world over and against the natural world with, around it. Instead, that there needs to be some form of balance, right? That's what the sense of iso in the Isegoria, I think, is rooted in, and that balance is kind of cosmic. And also that balance recognizes that there's no permanent way of guaranteeing the balance, establishing it for all time. So earthly flourishing actually grew out of those conversations and thinking about how, for Aristotle, flourishing only happens in the polis, and Aristotle doesn't have this vision of human and non-human life beyond the boundaries of the polis, but that flourishing, and this is a translation of eudaimonia, you know, which sometimes is translated as happiness, but it means much more than that, it captures the kind of realization of a natural balance and the fulfillment or perfection of capacities that are there, which I think Herodotus also has in mind. Like he's interested in human and non-human development. And many of the things that he wonders at are things that are like amazing animals that are perfectly suited for their environment, right? Or like amazing architecture that really like uses this place in a particular way and uses the natural environment or enlists it in its defenses or amazing strategies that adopt the knowledge of the particular place and its features. So those are all ways of humans and non-humans being cooperatively engaged and enlisted in their own development and living, right? Like there's a sort of like vitalism that undergirds, I think, this idea for Herodotus. And it's not simply like moral or ethical. So earthly flourishing was the term that Herodotus doesn't use this term. I mean, he talks about eudaimonia, but really in a pretty limited way, kind of restricted to ethical life and conversations among particular figures. But it was a way of capturing what I think Herodotus never fully names, but is on the horizon of his instruction. Again, maybe reading him a little more didactically than he's meant to be read, but that he sort of orients us toward this alignment and institutional environment that conduces towards all of our flourishing, all of our life, the greatest possible vibrancy of life, which would be not just human life, but also non-human life.
Does he have anything to speak towards, I guess, the debate in ancient political thought between, say, the theoretical or the philosophical life and the practical life, right? I mean, I guess one question is, what does he think about the philosophical life, or is there some kind of insight into that? But I also think about, when thinking about flourishing in an ancient context, it's hard not to think about, which is higher, which is more important, theoria or practice or deeds. Does he have anything to speak to that?
Yeah, I was thinking about that because I'm just reading Paul Ludwig's book on friendship, and I know you just talked to him. I need to listen to your interview. And I love it. And it's just like drawing me into this ancient psychology that is not in Herodotus, hardly at all. I think there are certainly stories that you could point to, and like especially people who, a lot of people talk about the exchange between Solon and Croesus in book one, and sort of the question of like who's the happiest, and Croesus is Solon's example. And Solon, of course, is this Sophistes. He's a wise man who has, in some sense, lived both the contemplative life and the active political life. But his examples are not of people who have pursued power and glory, but rather of people who have like lived out their life on the conditions that they found themselves in to the fullest. So there are stories like that. But on the whole, I think Herodotus is interested in something more like what Dana Villa calls, or Arendt, public happiness. He's more oriented toward thinking about how are collectives going to flourish. And so that's again, goes back to his sort of attention towards the nameless or the quotidian, the minor figures, as much to the major figures. One of the fantasies I have about Herodotus is that he and Sophocles were friends. There are like connections between the two of them. I think they really have a similar orientation towards hubris and towards tyrants, and towards and they have this idea that the people with the greatest lives on the outside are often the ones that fall the farthest and hurt the most. And Sophocles, I think, has a wonderful sense for minor characters who are like the best people on stage, right? They're the ones who tell the truth. They're the ones who report the facts. They're intimidated, and yet they say what they're going to say. And also those who have sort of been abandoned or forgotten. I think Herodotus has this too. And so his counsel about the best life may be, you know, live as prudently as you can within the confines of your life. Do not try to deny them or overcome them or refuse them. And if you're handed leadership, or you find yourself in a position of leadership, like, to absolve yourself of that responsibility as best you can. Like, don't try to glorify yourself any further. And in that sense, he's like very different from the epic tradition that preceded him, but maybe leading towards contemplation.
I wanted to just conclude by with your conclusion, where you sort of bring Herodotus back to the present, back to the Anthropocene, and offer some reflections on, you know, how he can guide us for the present. And you have some suggestions on the kind of some collaborative projects that Herodotus may have anticipated. So maybe just conclude, say a little bit about what you think we could learn in our era to sort of help stave off environmental catastrophe.
Yeah, Herodotus is really, as I was just saying, a thinker of collectives and collective power in a way that I think is very different from other people in antiquity, but also from the way we think about today. You know, it's something that I always like to remind my students of, is they have the power to bring the trustees to campus in a matter of days. All they have to do is organize. Like, it's that simple. And there are plenty of examples of that in the past by walking out or just occupying buildings. That that sort of mentality, I think, is very much in Herodotus, but in a constructive way, in the sense that he's showing how collectives can organize themselves around norms, nomoi, of equality, and that can take account of and acknowledge the vital contributions of non-humans to our collective flourishing. So in that sense, like, he's inviting curiosity and wonder, but he's also, I think, giving us instruction about the power that we have, we as a collective. One of the things that I think is really fascinating in Herodotus is he never uses the first person plural pronoun. He sort of speaks from his own first person singular perspective. And, you know, he was, another thing worth saying is, like, he wasn't an Athenian. He wasn't sort of an insider in the way that a lot of the other Plato was, Socrates was. He wasn't, he was an outsider for all these places that he went and reported on. But he's constantly admiring the ways in which people in the plural do things and get things done. And being like, even when he's describing how great figure like Cyrus frees the Persians, he also is saying the Persians freed themselves. Like, and this, there's this moment in the creation of the Athenian democracy that's so important, which is when Cleisthenes, as the way people usually describe it, introduces his reforms. But Herodotus is the one who gives us the best description of this incident. He says that he took them into his hetairos. He made them part of his club. And the people then are like, they are insiders with him, and the people are responsible. It's not he who frees them, but the people with him who free themselves. This emphasis, I think, on collective capacity and the sort of anticipation of what Josiah Ober calls the people's capacity to do good things in public, which is his way of defining what democracy came to mean, I think is really, really, really powerful now when we feel so overwhelmed by the magnitude of the challenges that we face and so powerless as individuals or as, you know, simply cogs in these much greater machines, that organizing around isegoria and practices of equality, organizing around our like sort of already existing relationships, can create the power and can create the relationships and the knowledge for us to face many of these challenges.
Well, Joel, great book, great conversation. Always great to talk to you, my friend. Thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Oh, it's been great, Jeff. I wish we had more time for Hegel, but maybe I can interview you when your book comes out.
I can't wait for that. Thanks, Joel.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.